Albert Einstein called the intuitive or metaphoric mind a sacred gift. He added that the rational mind was a faithful servant. It is paradoxical that in the context of modern life, we have begun to worship the servant and defile the divine. Welcome to A Walk Within, a show where we visit a short story from around the world and revisit life experiences invoked by it to explore the parallels between the two and find newer meanings. I'm Anoop, and in today's episode, we will explore a short story, John Harper's Insight, by Dick Purcell, published in October 1956 issue of Imagination, Stories of Science and Fantasy magazine. And my memory when I left my job abruptly, highlighting a power that we all possess. Before we start, I want to thank all the listeners for their continuous support of the show. Please consider sharing this with your friends, family, and even co-workers. As always, let's start with the story once we are back. Can the mind breach time? Harper was sure he had caught a news item that would change his life. Ironically, he caught only a part of it. They thought he was insane, and with good reason. Here was a man who'd spent his life in a machine shop, coming down one morning to say, in all apparent sincerity, "I've decided to be a concert pianist." Jan Grabowski, on turret lathe, grinned and said,
"Sure, John. They'll bring in a grand piano and you can practice between cards."
"They laughed when I sat down to the piano,"
someone bellowed, and there was general laughter, and the thing was forgotten. But later, when he told the boss he was quitting, they looked at each other in amazement. He'd evidently gone mad, and that was no laughing matter, because they liked John. Sam Payne, harassed plant manager, still found time to be human. When he discovered John was serious, he sat down and gave him half an hour, figuring he could find a quirk and straighten the man out. As they went to his office, he swiftly classified his employee. "John Harper, 33 years old, introverted, intelligent over and above his job." Harper seemed to be without ambition though, and Sam wondered about this but had never had time to talk with him much. After the half hour was up, Payne sighed and let him go. Obviously, the concert pianist gag was a cover-up for something else. Some fancied wrong, perhaps plain restlessness. Alone, Payne went back over the conversation, intrigued by John Harper's strange determination.
"This talk about a concert pianist is a gag, of course, isn't it, John?"
"No, Mr. Payne."
"But man, you're too old to start a thing like that. You never in your life studied music, did you?"
"No, sir."
"Then let me tell you. First, in a thing like that, you got to have talent. Have you got talent?"
"I don't know."
"Well, let's say you have, just for argument's sake. Alright, talent has to be caught early and nourished. Like a seed. Get what I mean? A man can't start at your age and get any place in a game the experts started in at 8 or 9, as children."
"You may be right, Mr. Payne, but maybe that doesn't apply to me." "Maybe it does, of course, but I've got to find out." Sam Payne gave up. He told John Harper his job would be waiting when he wanted it again, even gave him an extra week's pay. But that was to solve his conscience, because he felt he should bring in a psychiatrist at company expense to see what had gone wrong with Harper. Then he shrugged and put the thing out of his mind. Funny thing happened in this day and age, he thought. The trouble was he didn't really know John Harper. No one did. A bachelor, Harper lived alone, thought alone, and suffered alone. He hated the futility of his life, the work he was doing, the passing of unfulfilled days and nights. He felt a strong pull of destiny he could neither explain nor deny. An unreasoning certainty that he, John Harper, was meant for better things. Or perhaps a single better thing. He lived with this certainty while the unfulfilled days and nights piled up, until the misery became a pain and possibly demanded some sort of recognition by its very existence. At any rate, the morning of the day he quit his job, he had just awakened to the old familiar dread of the day ahead, a dread almost akin to a physical sickness. He was sure he did not go back to sleep, but he clearly saw, on the floor, within range of his eyes, a television set. The picture was bright and clear. A famous newscaster, with the smile known from coast to coast and the rat-a-tat voice that was his trademark. He was beginning his broadcast with the standard opening line.
And now folks, what's been going on in the world? John Harper, the great concert pianist, the man who brought long-haired music into the home, the man loved by millions, will...
The voice and the image vanished. Then the set faded and John Harper lay tense in the bed in his shoddy little room. But a different John Harper now. In an instant, he became a dedicated man, knowing he had been building up for this moment for years. This was the incident Sam Payne did not know of, nor did anyone except John Harper himself. He had a little money saved up, a few hundred dollars, and he went straight to a music school. His difficulty was that he could not camouflage his ambition, or rather his intent, and after stating exactly what he proposed to do, he was turned down by 5 reputable maestros in a row. So he gave up seeking instruction and rented a piano. He was fortunately situated in that his room lay at the back of the resident hotel where he lived, and the walls were as thick as the building was old and shoddy looking. He bought some instruction books at the second-hand store and went to work. He practiced, plowing doggedly through the intricacies of the notes and scales until his money ran out. Then he got a job washing dishes and practiced all night, until he was able to present himself again at a music school where the maestro was, fortunately, both honest and possessed of a conscience. His honesty said, "Send this man away." But John Harper had just enough pathetic skill and foggy talent that the instructor's conscience dictated the final policy.
"I will teach you,"
he said, adding to himself,
"It will be an act of charity, nothing more."
He would have been astounded, however, had he known that 4 short months ago, John Harper did not know even the scale. John told no one this. He told no one anything, but he applied himself to the piano with a single-mindedness that made a fanatic seem changeable as the wind by comparison. And soon, Professor Heinrich, he of the conscience, was confronted with something he could not understand. Genius was blooming and functioning before his eyes. The rest is history. It is told in hushed tones how this sad-faced, middle-aged man with no background, he was called the man from nowhere by certain romantically inclined critics, gave his first recital in New York City. It was given exactly 7 years from the day he told Sam Payne, "I'm quitting to become a concert pianist." The television network found him quickly, and he rocketed to fame by giving classical music an interpretation that made it understood and loved by millions. It was said that John Harper gave more musical pleasure to the world in his brief 2-year career than had any other genius in a natural span. But of course, the 7 years had taken their toll. The punishment of learning would have killed a far younger and stronger man than John Harper. So after a tragically brief time at the top of his ladder, John Harper was subject of a newscast by a famous newscaster with a smile famous from coast to coast and a rat-a-tat voice that was his trademark.
And now folks, what's been going on in the world? John Harper, the great concert pianist, the man who brought long hair music into the home, the man loved by millions, will be buried tomorrow in New York City.
Now here is my memory. I was in a small isolated town with only a 10-kilometer long single lane road connecting it to a national highway. There's only one way in and out. Despite its modest population, the town was known as one of the world's top producers of coriander seeds. This means that all of the farmers from the surrounding villages would flock to town to sell their harvest to traders who would then export it further, both nationally and internationally. The town had a very good economy driven by this grain market. I was part of the printing press business. I would design visiting cards, business stationeries like letterheads, receipt books, and so on for local traders. There was also a sizable market for wedding invites, because for those, the only other alternative was to travel 3 hours to another city. Why not get some personal work done while we are here for business? The farmers reasoned. To make the offer appealing, the firm owner bought in a new printing press machine and employees from big city, including a machine operator and a graphic designer, which is me. On that day, as I approached the shop, the business owner welcomed me with a good morning. Because it's Wednesday, my answer was lukewarm, as usually Wednesdays were filled with unwanted attention from local sellers and buyers on the street, who would look at me with curiosity and most of the time amusement, as if I were some kind of unusual animal they had never seen before. It had something to do with the box I'd be sitting in. The computer room was an 8-foot long, 5-foot wide box. It was mostly made of wood, but it had enormous see-through glass windows on all sides to attract customers. This is the box I'd occupy every day, expecting that the world would just go dark or that I become invisible. The night matures quickly in small towns, and after dinner, my roommate, the machine operator, one of the local co-worker, and I was sitting in our room and the power outage hit us. The power outages were a part of life like sunrise and sunset. My roommate lit a small candle, but before we could settle in, we decided to go to the roof to enjoy the night sky. The topic of discussion ranged from technical issues that these power outages caused to the press, to how our local co-worker messed up one of the jobs, resulting in a total loss of paper, ink, and time when the machine could be operated in power supply window. The business owner was not pleased, and he lectured both of them. The co-worker wondered why it's impossible to keep a track of time in the darkness.
"What time is it?"
he asked. When I replied 8:30, he commented,
"No, it's 9 p.m. You need to get a new watch."
I sighed and said, "You know what watch I want to buy? I would buy an Omega someday." My roommate suggested that I should buy a Timex, a respected brand in India, and don't waste money on non-branded watches. "Excuse me? Non-branded?" I inquired in offended tone.
I never heard of it.
The co-worker chimed in. Really? You know who wears an Omega? James Bond. I clarified while still in shock.
Who is James Bond?
You're kidding, right? James Bond? 007? Super spy? I inquired confusingly and yet genuinely.
Never heard of him.
I couldn't hear them anymore and couldn't feel anything other than this thought. They don't know who James Bond is? I decided to leave the town right then. It triggered a war within me. On one side, the rational thoughts like, it's just a fictional character. Why does it matter? You are here working for money and have debts to pay. What would you do if you leave this job? It's not like you have some job waiting for you. And on the other side, a single thought. Would I want to live where people don't know who James Bond is? I packed my bags against the constant questions and protest from my roommate. Spoke to a local friend who had a transportation business, and I was sitting in a freight truck heading back to Indore at 10:30 p.m. One of the clearest parallels between the story and my memory is this. Both John Harper and myself were triggered by an outlandish reason. He by a vision of a news report, and I due to my unnecessary and unwarranted devotion to a fictional character. As Malcolm Gladwell talked about in his book titled Blink, how we think without thinking, about choices that seem to be made in an instant, in the blink of an eye, that actually are not as simple as they seem. We call it intuition. While different fields use the word intuition in very different ways, generally it's the ability to acquire knowledge without recourse to conscious reasoning. Intuition in philosophy is the power to obtain knowledge that cannot be acquired either by inference or observation, by reason or experience. Normally, we call intuition as instincts, gut feeling, or hunch. However, Francis Scholl defines it differently. For example, instinct is our innate inclination towards a particular behavior, as opposed to a learned response. While a gut feeling or a hunch is a sensation that appears quickly in our consciousness, noticeable enough to be acted on if one chooses to, without us being fully aware of the underlying reason for its occurrence. Lastly, intuition is a process that gives us the ability to know something directly without analytic reasoning, bridging the gap between the conscious and subconscious parts of our mind. We all use intuition more often than we realize. Even in cases when we think we are acting rationally, we are probably justifying our intuition. Intuition is highly efficient in decision making, and its effectiveness diminishes as we start thinking about it too much. While stress triggers habits and shortcuts, it degrades our sophisticated intuitive processing. While both me and John Harper ended up getting positive benefits of intuition, there are many drawbacks to it. More specifically, we tend to cling to our own intuition despite its dangers. For example, intuition can lead to all sorts of cognitive and social biases and prejudices. So how can we get better at this? We all have that inner voice, and we too can build more qualitative, intuitive thinking by following some of these steps. First, train your subconscious with newer experiences to improve the quality of our intuitions. Second, keep a journal as it might assist the subconscious mind to open up. Lastly, turn off your inner critic and stop rationalizing away that voice within. Instead, let it flow freely. In the end, in certain situations, intuition is far superior to conscious analysis, whereas sometimes it can lead to bad choices and unfair appraisal of others. Neither head or heart can survive on its own. and we should always seek balance. As Eugene Sadler Smith said, it's not about whether intuition or analysis is best. The real skill in decision-making, problem-solving, creativity, whatever, is blending these two things together. And in a way, that's kind of a lifetime project, isn't it? That's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. As I said before, if you like the content, please consider sharing it with others. It's much appreciated. The link to the story on Project Gutenberg, along with two wonderful blog posts from Psychology Today on intuition, are available in the show notes. Before you go, I want to thank you for continuing to support the show. Till next time, stay as awesome as you are. Thank you.